morning. It's good to have all of you here. If you notice, this is the beginning of the Advent season. We have the we have everything kind of decorated. Thank you again for everyone who helped out with decorations. We have Jerusalem, and we have kind of the little stable over there. If you notice, the stars lit, which is really wonderful. And we're kind of moving towards Christmas. I kind of noticed as like the last couple weeks, as November was kind of wrapping up, and as we're moving into December, I kind of noticed that for a few weeks, when people would come up and ask me, say, "How are you doing?" I started answering more and more, "I'm tired." Like, "I'm tired." And I think part of it is like a physical thing. Part of it is like an age thing, the fact that I'm getting older. As I'm getting older, my body's kind of wearing out and I need to sleep more. I have less energy. But I also notice, like, I think part of it's spiritual. I think to some degree, like I kind of have this like feeling of being like a little spiritually run down, little kind of worn out spiritually. And the reason why I bring that up is I don't mean to bring it up so that you guys come up and say, "Oh, how are you doing?" The reason why I bring it up is because I think in a lot of other conversations I've had with people and just kind of watching, I think a lot of us feel like that. This is kind of the part of the year and part of time in the year in general where we do begin to feel kind of worn out and run down. And I kind of notice, for a lot of people, it's not just this like being tired from the holidays, from Thanksgiving. I sense it in the conversations and in the interactions that I have with people that that a lot of us are just kind of spiritually a little tired too. I look at the deacons and those who are serving in the church, and there's kind of this little feeling of like, it's been a long run. I'm tired and there's a lot that I've been doing. For other people, it's work. Work has been really busy. Lots has been happening and you feel this sense of like being worn out. For other people, it's studying. It's everything's kind of crescendoed and there's a lot of work to do. Other people, it's just been family. But regardless of whether it's like physical or something else, I mean, there's a spiritual tiredness too. Right? You begin to feel like you just struggle with your devotions. You start struggling with your prayer life. You start struggling with God in general. And one of the things that I want to share, one of the good things about Advent is supposed to help us in our tiredness. Advent is meant to be a time in which we slow down, we reflect, we remember, and we prepare spiritually to celebrate Jesus coming. What I wanted to do through Advent this year especially and through everything that we do is I wanted to do what I could to try to help you guys find like a spiritual sense of like rest, a spiritual sense of renewal as we go through Advent, so that through the process, not only are we fixing our hearts and minds on Jesus, but that we are pushing everything else aside so that we can pay attention first and foremost to Jesus and celebrate him. So if you notice, there are some things that we're going to be doing during Advent. We have this kind of devotional calendar, if you want to pick one up outside, that has these short devotionals that you can use every single morning, and they're meant to kind of refresh you, to slow things down, to give you a sense of rest. If you're kind of spiritually struggling, we have prayer meetings on Thursday that we want to invite you to come out to. They're online, so you can jump on and you can find some rest and renewal through that. I think even for the sermons in the next couple weeks, I'll try to do them with a soft voice so that you feel rested and you feel comfortable. And then obviously when we get to Christmas, we have Christmas service, which is the 24th, and the Christmas Eve service, which is the 24th that evening. But I want it to be kind of a time in which we can hopefully as a church, like spiritually push aside the things that are not important and spend our time thinking about the things that are and find rest and rejuvenation in those things. So Advent essentially starts with the most important question, which is this. The most important question of Advent is, who is Jesus Christ? Right? I mean, if Advent is all about this baby coming and being born in a manger, and I mean, the first thing we have to ask is, who is this baby? Right? For some of you, you've already answered that. You've thought about that a lot. Some of you really haven't kind of wrestled with that a lot. Regardless of whether you've answered that in your own life or whether you haven't, I want to try to help answer that question today. Who is Jesus? And what the Apostle John does is he gives us basically his summation of that. It's not a complete answer, but it's this incredibly full answer that begins to answer the question, who is Jesus Christ? Okay, so if you have your Bible, go ahead and open to it. And what I'll do is usually I give you the 3 points up front. I'm not going to do that because I think this will help you rest. But you know what I'm going to do is I'll give it to you as we go along. But we're going to try to answer the question, who is Jesus Christ? So the first thing we see in the passage is we see that Jesus is the rationale for life. Go into verse 1. And in verses 1 through 5, this is what John has to say about Jesus. This is how he encapsulates who Jesus is. He says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it." Now, there's a lot packed in there. What I want to point you to as we kind of start out and think about this idea that Jesus is the rationale for life is, if you notice, it starts with this idea of the Word, right? It says, in the beginning was the Word, and what John does is he carries this metaphor for Jesus all the way down to verse 14. He says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. And he continues to use this metaphor that Jesus is the Word. Now, that's a very, very interesting choice. In Greek, the word that's used there is this word logos. And in a very basic way, it's simple to translate. It could mean word, it could mean principle, it could mean a thought, it could mean a thing. But what John's doing here is he's actually taking this very simple word for a very important reason. In John's time, this was a very loaded word. It wasn't a simple word. It was actually a word that the philosophers used to argue about. If you would go see the philosophers debate, they would debate about this word. They would debate about what the logos was, right? What the word was. And basically, here's kind of the way that it worked. In Greek philosophy, philosophers looked at everything. They looked at nature, they looked at people, they looked at society. For instance, they would look at nature and they would, for instance, one of the things that came out is that in Greek philosophy, they understood that there were four basic forces of nature. So you had wind, you had air, you had water, you had fire. Right, a lot like Avatar. You had these four different elemental things, and these were the elements, these were the powers of the world. I can tell those of you laughing have watched it, but these are the main things. They looked at human life, they looked at people, and they said, well, people have emotions, their passions, there's rationale, there's intellect, and they tried to understand people. They also looked at society, they looked at classes, they looked at class structure, they looked at justice, they looked at injustice. And basically what they were trying to do was they were trying to figure out of all these different realms, all these different parts of reality, they thought there has to be something that makes sense of all of it, right? There has to be something that makes sense of nature, that makes sense of people, and makes sense of society. There has to be something that basically tells us what all of it is about, that fills it with meaning, that makes sense of it all, that gives us clarity. And for the Greek philosophers, they thought and they thought and they thought and they debated about what that logos was. And they tried to come up with their own answers. They tried to say, well, maybe it's living like this. Maybe it's the world like this. Maybe it's this other thing. And in the middle of this intense debate about what is the thing that makes sense of every other thing, John says, it's Jesus. John says, it is Jesus. Jesus is the thing that makes sense of every other thing. He is the thing that brings meaning, that brings purpose, and that brings direction. That's a really powerful statement to make. Right? When John starts out and he says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him. Without him, not anything was made. What he was saying to the philosophers and to the Christians is that Jesus is the thing that brings your life meaning. And you know what? Every single one of us has to live our lives by meaning. You may not think a lot about what that meaning is. Even if you've never asked yourself the question, what is my meaning? What is purpose in life? You live by purpose. You can't live your life without it. Even if you've never asked that question, you have a purpose. You just haven't stated it. You know, for some people, for instance, that meaning could be living for a spouse, living for a loved one. For other people, it could be living for things like success, living for things like achievement. But every single one of us has something that, whether we speak it aloud or whether we have it hidden deep in our hearts, we say, this is the meaning of life. This is the purpose of life. And essentially, there is a danger. If you do not have the right meaning, everything gets messed up, right? Let me give you an example. Let's say that you're outside kind of rummaging around. You're out looking for things, and you stumble upon this metal box, right? You find this metal box and it has this cord. And you say, oh, this is interesting. I'll take it home and I'll see what this is. And you kind of stare at it and you turn it and you try to figure out what it is. And then it hits you. You say, I've heard about these things. I think this is what they call a hand warmer. So you plug it in, slide your hands in, and right at the moment where it's too late, you notice there's an inscription on the bottom of this metal box that says Toastmaster, right? You're in a lot of trouble because that's not what the purpose is. Right? If you don't understand what the purpose of something is, you bring great harm to yourself or you destroy the thing itself. Right? Like, purpose is an important thing. And the thing is, we know everything has a purpose. Everything has a meaning. Everything has a reason. Right? Everything is built for something. And if you don't understand what that is, it causes unnecessary, sometimes excruciating pain. And you know, that's what the Greek philosophers understood. They said they were out to find out what the meaning of life was, what the purpose of life was, and what they believed is this. They went a step farther and they said, once we understand that, we have to conform our lives to it. When you understand what the purpose of life is, what you understand what the meaning of life is, you have to conform your life to that. And essentially what John is saying, this is what the philosophers were searching for. This is what you're looking for. Jesus is your rationale. He is your reason. He is your meaning. He is your purpose. And you know, like I said, life does have meaning. There's a lot of ways we can kind of figure it out on our own, not always the right way. It's not always what other people say. And contrary to popular belief, you can't decide your own meaning. You can't make it up on your own. If you say your life is about money, you can spend your whole life accruing money only to realize at the end that it was wasted. You can say that your life is about accruing power, and at some point, through your success or through your failure, you might realize it really wasn't about that. It was really about something else. You could spend your entire life saying, my life is about experiencing pleasures, and then realizing at the end that it was worthless. You can spend your life saying, my life is about my kids, and down the road realizing that it should be about something deeper, something bigger. But basically, you know, as Christians, it's not enough for us to understand what the meaning is. We have to conform our lives to it. If we don't, then it's hands in the toaster, right? It's the same thing. John says Jesus is the rationale for life. He is the way through which you can understand what your life is for. And you know, the most powerful part of that statement is John is saying to the philosophers, John is saying and John is also saying to believers like us, he is saying, your meaning, your rationale, your purpose, it's not a philosophy, it's not a principle, it's a person. That your life was meant to be wrapped up in Jesus Christ. That you are meant to live your life for him. And you know, when you conform your life to that, you weren't meant to live for yourself, you weren't meant to live for wealth, you weren't meant to live for fame. If you conform your life to the fact that you are made to live for him, you find peace. So that's the first thing we see. We see that Jesus is the rationale for life. Second thing we see is that Jesus is the authority for life. If you go back to verses 1 through 5, actually 1 through 3, I want you to notice verse 3. Verse 1, he says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God." Now listen to verse 3. "All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made." Now, that's it's an incredibly powerful statement to make. If you notice, from verse 1, what John is doing is John is imitating the style of Genesis 1, right? Genesis 1 starts, "In the beginning, God, da-da-da-da-da." What John does is he starts his gospel, he says, "In the beginning was the Word." And what he's pointing out is he's pointing out the deity of Jesus, that Jesus isn't just some baby that's born, he's not just this teacher, he is God himself, that he is second person of the Trinity. And so thus, verse 3, he says, "All things are made through him." That makes sense. If Jesus is deity, if Jesus is God, then all things were made through him, and without him, nothing was made that was made. Essentially, what John is saying is that Jesus is the author of everything. He's the one who created everything. Now, what's interesting is we usually don't connect the words author with the word authority, even though they're connected, right? But essentially, they are, right? For instance, if you were in a literary class and you were reading To Kill a Mockingbird, right? American classic. If you were reading To Kill a Mockingbird and you're reading a certain part of it, you said, what is this meant to tell us about society? And you have this big discussion, and you know, five different people argue about five different viewpoints of what it says about American society, what it says about us as people, what it says about race, what it says about race relations, what it says about, you know, all these, and you get into this huge argument, right? None of you can agree. Well, to some degree, you look at each other, you go, "I guess we're all right," right? Like, who's to say? But imagine in the middle of the conversation, right, Harper Lee walks in. And in the middle of your argument, you know, at first you'd be shocked because she passed away. But after you got past that, you know, like if she heard the conversation, she'd say, wait, she'd say, "It's not about those things, it's about this." Then my guess is, first of all, you would go, "Oh," right? Because she's the author. She's the one who is writing it. She was the one who put it together. It's not like the author would come in and say, "Oh, I was really writing about this," and you would go, "That's not right." She's the author. Or if you were, you know, let's say that you were with musicians and you were all trying to learn how to play Moonlight Sonata, and Beethoven walked in. And you argue about, "Oh, it should be this way, this pacing, no, this phrase is this way," and you all begin to argue. If Beethoven walked in, if he said, "No, this is how it's supposed to sound," you would all go, "Yeah, that's exactly, okay, let's play it that way," right? Because he's the author. What John is telling us is that Jesus is the author of everything. And if that's true, it means that he is the authority over everything. It means that what he says goes. That's an astonishing claim to make, right? It means that John is saying that Jesus is the authority. It means that what Jesus says, that's what it is. It means that when it comes to living your life, he knows exactly how it's supposed to be designed, right? And we have a lot of questions like that, right? We live our lives and we ask ourselves things like this. We make decisions like this. How should I live, right? That's a moral question, right? How should I live? Is it okay to lie? Is it okay to treat people poorly? I mean, how should I live? We also ask questions like this. How should I use my time, right? How should I use my resources? Should I be stingy? Should I be generous? We ask questions like this. How should I use my body, right? Sexuality. How should I use my relationships? And you know, if there is no God, right? If there's no God, if there's no author, you can do whatever you choose. You can do whatever you want. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Here's the thing. If there is a God, then you do have an author. And he's the one who can tell you how all of that's supposed to work. And if he does, right, you can't look back at him and say no. You can't look back and say, you don't know, you don't understand. Right? If he's the author, he knows. You know, I'll give you another case. You know, I think in a lot of ways we don't like this idea of God being the author or being our authority, because we want to say, like, no one has the right to tell me what to do, right? I'm my own boss. I'm my own author. But again, if you're not your own author, you have to consult the one who is. Now, even if you don't believe in God, even if you don't have God in your worldview, even if you don't want God to be a part of it, you're still not your own author. I think in 2019 there was a case brought. If I'm correct, it was in Dubai. I could be wrong about this, but it was an Indian man. He brought a lawsuit against his parents. He's a 27-year-old man. He brought a lawsuit against his parents. He was living at home. His parents wanted him to kick him out of the house so that he get his own life and make his own way in the world. And he was perfectly content living off his parents, living in the basement. I don't know if he's playing video games, but, you know, sure, you can put that into the illustration. But this 27-year-old man, you know, getting kicked out of his house, he sued his parents, and he made the claim that his parents are financially responsible for him for the rest of his life. And the reason why is because he never asked to be born. He said, I'm not the author. I didn't make the choice to be born. They made a decision. They wanted to make a child. If they made that decision, they need to take care of me. Right? And so he made a legal case that his parents financially would have to take care of him the rest of his life. Let him live however he wants. You know, even without God, this guy understood something. He's not his own author. Right? He's not the reason why he's here. If you have an author that's not you, then you have an authority. You have someone who knows you, understands you, and who has every right to say, this is how you should live. This is what you should do. This is what you should be. And John says, Jesus is that authority. And you know what? You cannot live well. You cannot live satisfied. You cannot live a sense in which you feel complete and whole until you let him be your authority. You cannot live in a way that's satisfied or whole until you let him be your authority. So that's the second thing we see in John 1, is we see that Jesus is the authority of life. Third thing we see at the very bottom through verses 14 through 18, and I'll read it first. If you go to verse 14, it says, and the word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him and cried out, this was he of whom I said, he who comes after me ranks before me because he was before me. For from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace, for the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, the only God who is at the Father's side, he has made him known. Now, the third thing that I wanted to show you is that in this passage, John makes the case that Jesus is not just the rationale, he's not just the authority for life, he's also the comfort for life. If you go into verse 14, he has this wonderful, wonderful kind of beginning to the section. He says, and the word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. Again, he's using this idea of word, this idea that Jesus is the rationale, the meaning, the thing that pulls our lives together, the thing that makes sense of ourselves and our identity and the world around us. And he basically says, like, it's this Jesus, it's this rationale, it's this meaning. He says, this thing became flesh and dwelt among us. Now, what's really powerful about that description isn't just the idea that it became flesh, but he uses this phrase, dwelt among us. And it's a Greek kind of phrase that's a transliteration of a Hebrew word, which is the word tabernacle. If you remember in the Old Testament, the tabernacle was this makeshift tent that they put up in the desert that housed God and essentially the temple, right? God and the ark and all the holy things. And what's really interesting is if you go back into the Old Testament, In Exodus, they're told to create this tabernacle, and then when they put the ark in there, God would live there. God would be there. They could go in, and they could be in the presence of God. And so they built this tabernacle that was a court and an outer court, and this essentially a fence around it. And what's really interesting is, living in the desert, they all put their tents around this tabernacle. So that essentially they were all facing this building, this makeshift thing that was called a tabernacle. And essentially it was this picture and this image of the fact that God had essentially come down from heaven and was living in the midst of his people. And when God would get up, they would follow. When God would set down, they would lay the tabernacle down, they would put all their tents around it, and they would surround this tabernacle. And for Israel, right, there was this unique thing where God lived where they lived. God was there with them. Now, why would God go to such a great length to build this imagery and to build this idea? The fact that there's this huge tabernacle that houses God and the tents and the clans and the people all surrounding it is, you know, why would he do that? Because there's a message in it, and the message is actually one of the things that's at the very heart of Christianity. If you go to Matthew 1, there's this prophecy about this child who's going to be born, and this Old Testament prophecy says that child will be born for a virgin, and he will be called Emmanuel, God with us. The tabernacle was a physical manifestation of this promise that God would come to live with his people. And this idea of Jesus, this idea of Jesus is that Jesus was coming to live with his people. And again, the question is why, right? Why is that such an important concept? Because comfort, right? Why did God come to live with his people in the desert? Comfort. They placed their tents around and they looked in, and every time they saw the tabernacle, they knew as people they were safe. God was their protection. God was their counsel. God was their direction. God was their light. If you remember later on in Israel's history, there's a period where they decide to take the ark into battle. They think if we take the ark of God into battle, God will do this incredible thing because he has to protect it, and the enemy army will fall, and they'll, you know, then we'll win. And if you remember, what happens is the enemy army overruns them, they take the ark and they take it to their temple. And if you remember, what the response was from the Israelites was, said, what are we going to do? We've lost our God. Right? They were depressed, they were saddened, they were disheartened because they couldn't find comfort. You know, this idea of the Word becoming flesh and dwelling, tabernacling, living among his people, that Jesus is going to come and be Emmanuel, God with us, is comfort. You know, for a lot of kids, especially young kids, they need something to comfort them. I had a coworker years ago who she was going through this process of trying to get her daughter off of pacifiers. And for her daughter, like, pacifiers were huge comfort, right? When her daughter realized that that her mom was starting to get rid of her pacifiers, she took all the pacifiers she could find and she hid them. She put them in all these different places around the house. And so, like, you know, my coworker would say that there are times where, you know, her daughter would run off to a corner of the house, and all of a sudden she'd hear, and she'd go over, and there she was with the pacifier. She'd take it away, and her daughter would cry, and then later on she'd hear, and she'd find another one. You know, we're like kids like that. Right? We need comfort. We find ourselves fearful and scared and worried. You know, spiritually, we're all still children. And what John says is that Jesus is our true and our deep comfort. You know, other religions promise comfort. This isn't kind of unique to Christianity, but if you go into Islam has comfort for this life. And the comfort is if you submit, if you obey the pillars, pray, pilgrimage, give, fast, declare your faith, you'll find comfort, you'll find ease. If you do those things, then you know you're in good standing with God and you can take comfort. If you go into Buddhism, they talk about comfort too. They say if you practice the disciplines, if you meditate, if you deny yourself, you'll find comfort. But here's my question. Can you really find spiritual comfort in obedience? Right? Can you really find comfort in spiritual practices, in more spiritual disciplines? If you're like me, if your comfort depended on your ability to do spiritual disciplines, there's no comfort in that. Right? We're always not doing those things. We're always failing. We're always giving up. If our comfort was found in our ability to obey the things that are in front of us, all of us would be in a lot of trouble. John says, there's only one thing that can give you true, lasting, deep comfort, and that is Jesus Christ. You know what Jesus says? Jesus says this amazing thing. He says, come to me, all you who are burdened, all you who are weary. Do you remember why? He says, I will give you rest for your souls. That's the rest we need. For those of you who are tired, like me, whether it's age or whether it's spiritual things, that's the only place we find rest. We find rest in his arms. And you know, in a minute, we're going to take communion. And communion actually tells us why it works like that. You know, in communion, we have bread and we have wine. And the bread isn't bread of peace. The wine isn't the wine of good times. The bread represents suffering. The wine represents torture, represents shedding of blood. You know, the reason why you and I can find rest in Jesus is because on the cross, Jesus found no rest. The reason why we can find comfort is that on the cross, Jesus found no comfort. And you can say, how does that work? Well, on the cross, Jesus took what you and I deserve. You and I don't deserve rest. You and I don't deserve ease. You and I don't deserve a sense in which like everything is right again. You and I are sinners. We stand before a holy God guilty. And what we deserve is we deserve wrath. We deserve condemnation. We deserve all the hard things. We deserve the whirlwind. And yet Jesus takes the whirlwind for us so that in him we find true comfort. We find a comfort we don't deserve. And so as we get ready to take from the table, as we get ready to take the bread and take the wine, let's take a moment and let's meditate. Let's pray. And let's remind ourselves of the comfort that we do have in Jesus, that he says, come unto me those who are weak and weary, and I will give you rest. Let's pray. And Father, that is the rest that we need. We are people who are physically and spiritually always running out of gas, always worn out, always burned out. And we need to find a place of solace, a place of comfort, a place to be rejuvenated. And Lord, you tell us that that place is you, that any other place is shallow, any other place is false, any other place is temporary. But in you, we find the rest that we need. And so, Lord, as we get ready to come to the table, as we get ready to eat the bread and drink the wine, give us a deep sense of rest through these elements, to see that through Christ, there's so much we don't have to worry about, that through Christ, there's so much that is no longer on our plates, that through Christ, there is one who knows, who sees, who understands, that through Christ, there is one who has taken the hardship that we deserve and who has offered us calm and peace. May we find our rest in you. Pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. I'm going to ask Justin if he can come up and help serve communion. As I mentioned, we have the elements in front of us. And What we're going to do in a minute is we're going to invite you to come and take of the elements, to come through the center aisle, come up to the altar, and to make your way out after that. I do want to encourage you, especially as we're thinking about Advent, to remember that this is the baby who came to be born in a manger, that he came to die, that he came to give his life as a ransom for many, and that he came to do it for you. If you know that's true for you, if you know that Jesus is your Lord, your Savior, then come and experience him through the bread and the wine. If you're not sure, then watch, then refrain and watch. And ask yourself whether you want Jesus to be your authority, whether you want him to be your Lord. And again, our hope and our prayer is that one day you decide that you do want that. For all the rest of us, as we have acknowledged Christ, let's feast on him to know that he is our strength,